You know, our podcast anniversary just passed, and I didn't even get so much as a card. So
podcast
I'm trying
anniversary.
Not. That's right. Jeez. I expect you to remember this stuff.
You're
okay?
Dipping deep with that crap.
No, I don't think so. Are you kidding me? Look, you got to celebrate everything. I went back on our podcast anniversary and I listened to our very first podcast, and you should know by now, since it's been two full years, that I pronounce some words exactly the same, even if they're different, because we had this exact same conversation.
I know, you're unchangeable. You're grammatically unchangeable.
Wendy and Wendy. And to me, Wendy. It sounds completely different. And evidently to you and everyone else in the world, it sounds exactly the same.
So. All right, Michelle, well, we're here, and we have about 200 podcasts in the West Coast Project podcast empire now.
Wow.
It's probably short of 200. It's probably about one in the 190s.
That's impressive.
I can't tell you the downloads. I know, like, Bald Move celebrates their 10 millionth download.
Wow.
I don't know how many downloads. I don't even know how to figure that out. I guess if you have, like, the right hosting source, they can tell you those stats. I don't know.
I'm sure there's a way.
Well, Michelle, we're here for West Coast Project's Fargo feed.
Yep.
Number 203, episode 3 of season 2, The Myth of Sisyphus. Say
You're
that.
Not make
say
me
that
say
three
that.
Times. The Myth of Sisyphus.
I can't say it once. Yeah.
Before we get into that though, Michelle from Tennessee, I've been traveling a lot, so I had some time to goof around on the internet, and I found out some stuff. And plus, I like reading Reddit, and I like listening to other people's podcasts. So, just to update a few facts and figures here, that kid Charlie, you may have already known this too during your time since our last podcast. The kid Charlie is the son of Bear, I think.
Right.
The palsy kid
mm-hmm.
who was counting the money with Grandma.
Right.
And Constance is Peggy's coworker at the beauty salon.
Constance. Okay, that was the one person that I could not find out her name, but it's Constance.
The
okay.
one who's
like the owner, the or the
yeah,
person.
The one who's hot yeah. for Peggy.
And yeah, we see it again.
And I think the sexy slutty girl in this episode is Simone.
That's Floyd's granddaughter, the daughter of Dodd.
Right.
Yeah, Simone.
Dodd's daughter. And the girl who reads the book in Bud's meat store is Noreen. She
okay.
reads the Myth of Sisyphus book. She's still reading it this episode, too.
Well, you know,
even
it's
in
a
this
long...
Myth of Sisyphus episode.
It's got to be hard to understand.
And then I had some questions, Michelle. I don't remember where I heard this, but I heard it somewhere. Why didn't they just run the license plates of all the cars at the restaurant and then back track to see who wasn't there? Rye's car would have known it's Rye in a second.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. Was it his? It was his car, I guess we're to assume, right?
Well, unless they drive around in like sterilized cars with registration that's blanked out, or rentals, or something, or just back in 1979, the license plate tracking sequence from the police was slower. Took longer?
Well, it would have had to have been, right? Because that was pre-internet.
I don't know.
So it would have had to have been...
But it seems like they needed to find the gun to figure out it was Rye when all it would have been was a license plate check.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but that's... You're right. If there was, like, a car left there, you would think... Even if it was... even if it had no license plate, and even if it was a rental, couldn't they do fingerprints on the car or something? I mean, they did on the gun. That's a good point.
But just a license plate, though. You'd think fingerprints would take a while to scan every criminal that's ever been fingerprinted and match the whirls and stuff, but
yeah,
a license plate.
But that's how they found him.
I know.
The fingerprint on the gun. I don't know.
Okay, and then also the last episode, the... before the law, we're trying to figure out the meaning of that. We struggled a little bit with just the parable. But I think connecting the parable to the story, if you think about it, the gatekeeper's grandma, right, Floyd. She's keeping Dodd from the law, from the answers, from the solution he wants.
Maybe, or maybe she's keeping the Kansas City gang from taking over her territory, who she's the law over.
Maybe, but I think it fits Dodd better because the gatekeeper doesn't physically overpower the person trying to get past the gatekeeper. They only keep them out by kind of authority and intimidation. And right. Dodd fits that. Dodd could easily just push this thin lady away and say, screw it, Grandma, I'm in charge. But he doesn't. He respects her authority. And she tells him to wait till the time is right. And he has to honor that just because he respects his mother's authority, you know, hit her as his mother.
But he's not honoring that.
Well, but he is in this episode. The family divided comes really back together in this episode.
Well, seemingly, but I still feel like he's just waiting on Rye. I think he's just waiting on Rye to get come on, he's kind of shown who he is, and he's going way out of his way to find out where Ra is. He's
well, searching. And maybe that, Michelle, in your genius again, you've uncovered the meaning of this episode, the myth of Sisyphus, is that the search for Ra is meaningless because we all know that he cannot ever be found. He won't come back to go to one side or the other ever because he's not alive anymore.
No, and he will never be found. You're correct.
So all of these, well, they might find him. They might find the belt buckle, trace it to Ed, trace it to the meat grinder. But he won't ever answer. He won't ever play a part in this anymore. So it's a Sisyphean task to try, yeah. You know, to try to put him back into play. Let's get him on our side and let's win him over and get him on our side. That's sure. Never going to happen. I don't know. That may be a stretch on the myth of Sisyphus, but I think the gatekeeper is Floyd, keeping people from this magical power of taking over this Gerhardt territory.
Well, that's very interesting. But there was another definition. Jane from Twitter sent it to me, and she said that a definition of before the law was, and then this is in quotes, a search for the second and concurrent meaning beneath the surface story. That's another definition of before the law. And Patrick Wilson and Ted Danson, of course, Lou and Hank, their characters were talking about this when they were talking out in front of the Waffle Hut, right? And she puts all that in there. The, you know, finding the guy hanging and then seeing the other guy hanging and seeing someone shot and then seeing someone, you know, shot through the cigar and then seeing someone else shot. So I thought that was a really good point. And that was a difficult one, the before the law. That the myth of Sisyphus was 119 pages of something, right? Like a 119 page philosophy. It was, it's not easy either. I mean, there was a lot in it. The end of it was the story of Sisyphus, right? But all right. Before that was a whole lot more.
It's a parable within a story, right?
Right.
And it's, yeah, Camus, Albert Camus, Camus, C-A-M-U-S.
Right.
Man's absurd, the philosophy of the absurd, man's futile search for meaning when they're in the face of an unintelligible world devoid of God or eternal truth. So searching for meaning in something that's meaningless is the theory behind Sisyphus.
Right. And then it goes on to say, does the realization of the absurd require suicide? And they say, no, it requires revolt. So well, I don't know.
Everyone knows what that means.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we're seeing now that Floyd says they're not going to lay down. You know, they're not just going to take it and just end because they can't, you know, maybe even succeed in what they're trying to hold on to. But they're going to revolt against Kansas City coming in. I don't know. I mean, I guess that's a stretch.
They're not going to revolt. They're going to defend themselves.
Right, right.
With violence, and Floyd's going to support that if it needs to be that.
Right.
All right, so let's get into this. Hanzi in the first scene is a boy in class with a magician showing the bunny in the hat trick.
Yep.
Hanzi. And then in real life, he's got a real bunny as kind of his prey that he caught somehow.
Yep.
Then there are several jump cut scenes with the split windows. Pretty cool. And Floyd is addressing the Gerhardt allies. Now, these trio of allies look like quite the trio. Who wouldn't want these guys on your side, right?
Yeah, they called them on IMDb. I think they were called the Gerhardt Mafia.
Otto's there. He's still alive, Michelle. He's propped up, but he's pretty quiet.
Yeah, he is.
So Floyd relates the Kansas City offer to her mafia. And Dot, of course, immediately rejects the offer. And Floyd reminds them that they're a peacetime family and that the Kansas City mafia is not like them at all. They're like all the sharks in the sea. So their first inclination is to take over via violence, if they can, I think, the Kansas City mafia. They offer something. If you refuse it, then they immediately go right to violence. And right, and we heard that from Joe Bulow, right, their leader. Like, if they take the offer, great. If not, we just send them, we send bodies or something, or bodies will stack up.
Well, yeah, but we kind of heard again in this episode. Remember, he says, we don't know if we'll offer more money or if we'll start wiping them out. So I don't think that's been necessarily decided yet, right?
Well, but we see a couple things. Like, we see these guys immediately pull their guns on policemen. They keep policemen away from a house because they're having a meeting, and because they're finally allowed to let in, they ask them to give up their guns.
I think I know.
They're pretty well. That's Gerhardt's, but I think that Kansas City people are pretty violent.
Oh, no doubt they're violent, and we're also seeing like Mike Milligan. He definitely got a little bit tougher this time. Did you notice? He kind of lost his sweet sing-songy voice a couple times.
Well, he's got to show his teeth a little bit, I think.
Right.
His fangs. So here we go. So Dodd, of course, is always chirping in that hit them hard or we wither and die. Right, Dad?
Yeah.
And then the allies, these three mafia dudes, complain about the country's status and how it's different under Reagan, or how it's going to be different under Reagan than it was under Carter.
Well, yeah, they're saying Carter's in and they have to wait in line to buy gas or something.
Right, they don't like Carter. So Floyd shuts it all down with, we fight on my terms and only as a last resort. The allies are supportive of this and they say that they won't make the first move, but they'll step in if the Gerhardts get attacked. So they're pretty good. They seem like a pretty good set of people to have on your side, even if they look goofy.
Yeah, they're definitely seem like they're going to be loyal.
So then now we hear a little bit more from Joe Bulow as he meets with Mike Milligan. Calls Floyd the Gerhardt Frau. That she's going to stall everything and then she'll pass. She'll stall on the offer and then she'll pass. She won't accept the offer. So he's already thinking of the violent stage. And Mike reports Rye is still missing. He gunned down a judge and then disappeared. They think he's on the run. He disappeared on the run.
Okay, I have a question here. How did Mike know that Rye killed that judge here? Because nobody else knows that yet.
Well, he knows about the typewriter and the judge blocking the funding and Rye going in on that. I think he's putting some pieces together faster than the police are.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know if I had just missed something along the way because I didn't see anybody tell him. I don't know who even would.
Well, Mike's figured this out. He's gone and figured out the typewriter angle, and then the judge, the skip guy who runs the typewriter store telling them that they needed money, and the judge blocked the money. He names the judge, Judge Bunt or Went or whatever her name is.
Yeah.
And then Rye's missing, and a judge is dead. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Rye's a partner in the typewriter business. I think it adds up pretty close to pointing to Rye.
Sure.
The other cool thing about this show now is we know what happened, but somehow, I don't know how they did this, but I'm I'm as interested in seeing the facts get uncovered as Lou and Hank and everybody else are. It's like it's fun to figure it out, even though we know what happened.
Well, it is, and you find yourself pulling for people that you that are doing stuff that you wouldn't maybe normally pull for in real life, and you want to see them maybe get away with some stuff.
Like who and what?
Well, I don't know, because as I was saying that, I don't know if I actually feel that way or not, but like Ed, I mean, I feel bad for Ed, and you know, I don't want the Gearhards to come after him, although I think we kind of know that's probably going to happen in some way, but I don't know. I mean, you just kind of are like, don't you feel bad for him?
Well, Ed's just a dupe. He's getting fooled by Peggy. He's kind of, he needs her companionship so badly that you feel like sorry for him more than pulling for him. Sympathy, I guess. Not really rooting for him.
Well, do you want him to get caught?
Well, I don't really care if he gets caught or not, but I don't want to pull for him.
Well, I don't want to pull for him, but I don't know. I just keep thinking, I don't know. I guess pull for him is not the right word. I feel an urgency when they're talking about what they're doing. Like she's, you know, leading him out of the butcher shop, and I'm kind of frantic with her, and I guess that's not really the same thing at all. I guess that's just the show pulling me along, but they do it pretty well.
So Hank and Lou talk, and they do share with us that Rye's print was on the gun. I can't remember if Lou tells Hank or Hank tells Lou, but they know now that it was Rye's print on the gun that they found. Probably Hank telling Lou, huh?
Yes. Yes. Hank called Lou on the little walkie-talkie and told him.
Okay, now we see Ben Schmidt and Lou. These guys are pals in the courthouse. They talk a little bit about the Gearhart family. And it seems that Otto's father, Dieter, ran liquor over the border or somehow through Minnesota. And then Otto took over when Dieter got killed or died off.
He got killed. Remember, 19 bullets in his head.
And I read this on Seppenwall. Somebody's made a comment on Seppenwall's website that the local cop Ben is Ben Schmidt, who was Gus's boss in season one. And Lou called Ben a prick in season one. So Lou did not, it comes to a point eventually where he does not like Ben. This is a reader of Seppenwall's site making a comment, so I don't know how true it is. But apparently, he's in the, and he seems to be in the control of the Gearhart family. In the, either the pay is on their payroll, or he's just intimidated by them somehow.
Yeah, I just felt like he was intimidated by them. He lives in the city, and we've seen, and we will see them say more, that they basically own the law enforcement or the judges or whatever, and you know, he's part of law enforcement. I thought that was a pretty interesting conversation that Ben and Lou had right there, and I felt like they were just meeting for the first time. Did you feel like they were friends? I thought they introduced themselves to one another.
Yeah, I think they were friends.
Oh, I thought they introduced themselves to one another.
Well, Floyd knows Ben's mother, so it was, and I don't know, Lou's been around there a while. I think they know each other.
Lou hasn't been around there. Lou is up in Fargo, right? He went to where the judge is, and remember, she came from a long way from where he lives.
Yeah, they live in Luverne or Lucerne. I think that's where Lou is, right? Lucerne, and the judge is from Fargo.
Right, so he went to Fargo, and it's a good ways away. Remember that they didn't know the judge.
Yeah, but what's that got to do with Ben knowing Lou?
Because why would they have known one another? They didn't work together or anything. This is a completely separate township. This is the township where the Gearhards live. And it's completely different than where the Salversons are.
So you think Lou went to Fargo and Ben was just the one in the courthouse showing him around, showing him the ropes and stuff?
I think Lou went to Fargo, and Ben was the one. He was there on some kind of police investigation over the judge that was murdered
or Ben was there under the Gerhardt family payroll to figure out what they need to know about the whole situation.
Yeah, I didn't get the impression that he was on their payroll, but I did get the impression that he knew. See, Lou didn't know the Gerhardts. When he heard the name Rye Gerhardt, it didn't strike any fear in him. He didn't say, oh, the Gerhardt boy, nothing. He didn't know him. But Ben knew exactly who the Gerhardts were. When he said Rye Gerhardt, he said, oh, that's the youngest, you know, of the Gerhardt clan. In you know heir the youngest heir to this and he was scared. Remember, Ben even said, "You would rather have found your own print on the gun than his print for all the trouble this is going to make you." Essentially, and I'm paraphrasing wildly, but
yeah, that's right.
I don't think they knew one another, and I didn't get the impression that Lou liked him at all. I've got the impression that he was really disappointed in his fear of the Gerhardts.
And then doesn't see Ben with the Gerhardts until later. When they're sitting in the courthouse, they talk like, I don't know, maybe I'm just reading too much into it, but I thought they knew each other.
I thought they didn't, because they were each saying, I was in the military, I did this. And the other one was like, I was in the military, I did this. I could be completely wrong, could have looked at it wrong. But I felt like they had just met one another for the first time.
No, stand up for what you think. Just say it. That's good. That's a good take. I'm probably wrong.
I don't know.
All right, Hansi's talking to Dodd's daughter as he carves up that bunny and eats the raw heart. Is that the heart he eats?
I think it might have been... Yeah.
He starts to ask her about Rye. Now, Rye's her uncle. Dodd's her father, so Rye's her uncle, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, is my head in the evil place here, Michelle? Is Rye screwing his niece, or is he just using his place for escapades and she knew about it?
Neither one, I don't think. I think that she went... Dodd sent her there, is what I think. To wait on somebody to come and then catch them.
Well, yeah, to catch Skip, that guy Skip.
Yeah.
She says even a girl's got to bust a nut every now and then. Like her Uncle Rye either screwed around with her or let her use his bachelor pad to screw around when she wanted to screw around on
her. Maybe she did talk about being close to him and talking to him and stuff like that. Like they said, he's talked to you more than anybody else or something like that.
So what is a girl wants to bust a nut every now and then? I mean, she's getting crazy with guys in his place.
Is that what that means? I don't even know. Okay. I don't even know what
that
means.
Come on, Michelle.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, she's like, she's drinking whiskey there and she's like, she's having sex with people there.
Well, she's drinking. The only time we've seen her there, I felt like was just the setup.
She's at home there, Michelle. She's been there before. Come on. She knows all about it. She's been there before.
I don't know. I don't know that.
A girl wants to get her groove. I'll transcribe it for you. A girl wants to get her groove on. A girl needs to... girls just want to have fun. She's been there before.
Yeah, I don't know.
She knew about it.
She's saying that to aggravate her dad.
No. She's talking to Hansi. She's talking to Hansi of the bunny, nobody else. He's asking her, what does she know about this place? Where is this place, secret place Rye had? Rye was her, like, uncle letting her use it for escapades.
Okay.
And
okay.
She tells Hansi where it is. He doesn't know where it is, and she tells him where it is.
Okay.
All right, and then we see Hank just by himself kind of quickly in his office reviewing evidence and posters, help us find Rye posters and stuff.
Yeah.
All right, and we go to the hair salon now. Peggy and Constance in the salon. Betsy's also there and complaining about her chemo hair loss or her fear of it. She's more afraid of losing her eyebrows than her hair.
Yeah, she said that would be true.
Interestingly. Mm-hmm. And Peggy admits now to Constance she's going to go to LifeSpring and that she didn't tell Fat Ed yet this. Constance again calls her a bad girl. You're a bad girl.
I know. She's calling her naughty and stuff. What is up with that? I mean, Peggy's like totally rebuffed her. She needs to slow down with that.
Betsy's about to shine here, though. So Hank comes in and puts the Rye poster in the window. And Betsy starts kicking in the advice on the evidence. Also, right before she starts doing that, Hank says, just like Frances McDormand did in the movie, you killed all these people and for what? A little money. Just like she did at the very end when she had the guy in the back seat of the police car. Told almost exact verbatim
line. Oh, wow.
It's a beautiful day. You killed all those people and for what? A little money?
I remember that.
He says almost those very words.
Perfect, yeah.
So Betsy offers that, hey, maybe the shooter was hit by a car and not escaped in a car. Super smart.
Sure.
And Peggy overhears this and starts to freak out.
Well, yeah, I mean, because right in front of her, they're coming up with the correct theory.
And she even says, she tries to sway that theory by saying, that don't make sense. And Hank even chirps in, yeah, you know, I think Peggy's right. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right. Who would do that? No one would drive away with a Gerhardt sticking out of their window. But see, there's some threads coming unraveled here because Constance saw her car wrecked. And remember, she started to say something about it right then. And that's when Peggy chimed up and kind of changed the subject. And so I think that Constance going to her house was more than finding the toilet paper, I'm afraid. I'm afraid we're going
to
see.
Well, yeah. People are going to leverage all these advantages to their advantage.
Right.
Peggy's going to leverage Todd giving her the bruise on the cheek. Constance is going to leverage Peggy and the car in the garage to get what she wants from Peggy. It's all going to play out that way.
I hope Peggy doesn't go against Ed, because this guy is like, he's, look at what he's doing for her.
Well, he's eating up a fair amount of the family's food budget. And Betsy leaves this conversation with a very intelligent look for a car, not a man. So that is exactly what they should be doing, Michelle from Tennessee.
Yep, you're right.
So Peggy immediately goes to get Ed from the meat shop. And they excuse themselves from this girl, this book girl, reading The Myth of Sisyphus, Noreen. And they have to deal with the car today. Can't be later. Has to be right now.
Right.
So we jump cut to Molly now watching Operation Eagle's Nest, a movie, I guess.
Yep.
And do you know what that was, Michelle? Eagle's Nest?
I do not.
It was a tank battle in North Africa between the Allies and the Germans, or the Axis powers. So this whole thing of Rye, Dodd, and Bear's family having been on the German side in the World War II. In World War II, not the World War II. But that was kind of interesting. And plus, little Molly watching a World War II tank battle movie. Isn't that kind of...
Yeah, and really engrossed in it, too. So it's like, I don't know.
Okay. Well, it looked like it had just started because they had the title on. So, all right, Ben and Lou are back at the courthouse. And now they meet this typewriter guy, Skip Sprang. He's outside in his gremlin. And they want to know why he was... That car was a gremlin.
Yeah, no, AMC I don't. Gremlin.
Pretty sporty little car for the 70s.
Yeah.
Piece of shit, but it was a pretty cool little car. And he talks up the typewriters. He doesn't even like consider he might be in trouble. He gets all excited about his typewriter. I think he's the Steve Jobs of typewriters, Michelle. He's just excited about typewriters. All he wanted was the money to get the thing started.
He does. He has full confidence in his entrepreneurship as a typewriter salesman.
He's engrossed with his typewriter business. In fact,
well, Mike, they're not just for women anymore.
And he calls them spaceships.
He does. Yes, he does.
Like that's the newest, coolest thing is a spaceship?
Yep.
But that's the 15th time we've heard spaceship references in this series?
At least, yeah.
So he tells these two cops, I guess Ben's a cop, right? Or is some sort of legal...
He's a cop, I think.
Tells them he's there in court for the hearing on taxes to get his typewriter funding released or up and running. And he went by Judge Munt's office. And that I think that's why they're interested in him, because he went by her office.
Yeah, he went up to, well, he didn't just go by there. He went up to her door, and he stood at her door, and he, like, it was like there was some invisible force holding him back, and then he turned around, and he walked away, and then he got halfway, walked away, and he turned back around and walked back up to the door and did it again, and Lou saw all that.
So, but Ben just thinks he's a sad sack and lets him go.
Yeah.
Worst thing that ever could have happened to poor old Skip Sprang. He should have been arrested. Might have saved him, at least for a little while.
I guess, yeah. Skip wasn't having a good day.
So he goes right to where he thinks Rye is, that playroom or that apartment.
Right.
And the sexy daughter, sexy Dodd daughter, what's her name? Simone?
Simone. Mm-hmm.
Entices him in. I'll even give you a lap dance. She's drinking whiskey, hands him a
whiskey.
Okay,
she didn't say lap dance. I think it's funny. That's what you heard, though. She just said, I might even dance for you.
Whatever. Well, what's the difference? What do you think she's going to do?
I don't think she's going to do anything except lure him in. But
dancing for you means... think she's going to mamba? What do you think dancing for you means? Like,
you're such a guy. Stripping? Dancing for... I don't know. I mean, it was definitely a provocative thing to say, but it wasn't lap dance necessarily, so...
Well, Hansi is behind the door. Yeah. But he's boring. She's bored with him. But they end up taking Skip out to have some fun.
Yeah. Fun for whom?
All right, we jump to Ed and Peggy trying to crash the car now.
Yep. Peggy and that scenery. Did you love that? They just get better and better with the scenery. That, like, smog feel. Not smog, but it's not smog. What is it? Like, mist field from the cold? I don't even know what you'd call that. We don't have that here. And that, fog. Like, lone tree. Is it? Would it be just fog in the cold? I don't know.
I think if the air is colder than the land, it makes fog, yeah.
Wasn't that beautiful, though? And you could see that, like, you know, tree. I don't know. That scene just really took me.
So Peggy has all the drunk driving procedures down from her dad. Her dad used to know what to do.
Her uncle, I think she said. Okay. Yeah. Because he used to drink Old Milwaukee.
And she calls Ed my paladin.
Yep.
And again, from Steppenwall, paladin is either a medieval knight or the gunslinger from a TV western in the 1950s.
Yep.
So she's working him still. I don't think she really feels that way. She's working him. And Ed immediately tries to do it and blows it. He slides on some ice and hits the thing backwards. But Michelle, he gets it right the second time and gets the whiplash from it.
He gets the whiplash. He does, yeah. As the tow truck's towing him away. I don't understand really how that would have accounted for that hole in the glass. If there was no one in the passenger seat. Or was he going to say Peggy was in the passenger seat?
Well, if you hit it hard enough, the windshield will just fall in. The whole windshield will shatter.
Okay.
But they'll be missing some glass. I guess if you were the Walter White and you put the plate back together and the piece was missing.
Yep.
But I don't know. Do you think a law, the sheriff department's going to put all the glass back together and say, hey, wait a minute, there's a hole missing.
No.
So it probably would have worked if the windshield broke and fell all the way in.
Right. I didn't see the windshield having been broke. I didn't know. See, what I'm thinking that they might do is say that, but they can't, that Peggy got the black eye from hitting the windshield or something, and that she broke the windshield. But too many people know that didn't happen. So, I don't know. Surely they won't do that.
Well, the only thing wrong with the car was the hole in the windshield. Ed had cleaned up everything else spotlessly and perfectly. That's all they had to explain was the hole in the windshield.
Right.
So, if they have an accident where the windshield gets trashed and it's not there anymore, there's no more hole and they can explain it. Nobody's really, as far as they know, nobody's really seen it.
Right.
You know, except Rye and Constance.
Yeah, Constance has, but I don't think, well, I'm sure Ed doesn't know that. But I just didn't even think about the whole windshield coming in. I didn't notice in the scene if that had happened, but...
Yeah, that was the plan, I think.
Okay.
And maybe even Peggy doesn't know that Constance saw the car. Or she might have seen the car, but not the windshield. That was kind of iffy, because she was still in the main part of the house. She was looking through the door at the car.
Yeah, she saw it, remember? Because she said, oh, no, what happened? And Peggy told her that Ed had hit a deer.
Okay, I forgot that. So
yeah.
Yeah, so they had to get rid of the windshield. I don't know. I guess it would work. I mean, unless, like I said, they piece it all back together and there's a circular hole missing.
Yeah.
But who's going to do that?
Yeah.
All right, so now Bear and Charlie are talking. And I think Bear says maybe we can sell Kansas City a piece of the business, but not all. And Charlie, I think, might be the Michael Corleone of this whole thing. He's been smart a couple times in this.
Yep.
He says they don't look like fellas who don't want to own they don't look like fellas who want to own half a car.
Right.
They would never agree to that, Dad. They want the whole business.
Right.
Pretty smart from innocent little Charlie here.
Yep.
And Bear wants Charlie to go back to school because he knows the bullets are going to fly pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
And even Grandma wants Charlie to leave. So they know that the shit's going to come down from Kansas City. And Grandma
agrees.
Does
he go away to school, though?
Why yeah, not? Go away to college or something or whatever, accounting school or, you know, trade school.
Okay. Yeah, I was just thinking they were saying go back, like, back to school as in, you know, okay, good.
Bear continues his magnificent dietary feats here with this turkey leg. He's eating a gigantic turkey leg.
Well, Bear was hungry.
Okay, Ben and Lou now go to the Gerhardt house, the Gerhardt fortress. They have
the
guards
compound.
At the gate.
Yeah.
They want to take their guns at the front door of the house, and Lou won't give up his gun. He's pretty stubborn about that. Now, Floyd comes out, and she knows Ben and his mother. Like we said, she knows his mother. I forget her name, but she calls his mother's name out. And then Bear comes out. And then Lou tells them that Rye's prints were on the judge's murder weapon. And Floyd just says, look, you need to leave. She's totally protecting the family here.
Yep.
And then the men pull the guns on the cops. Now, that's ballsy. The men, the guardsmen of the Gerhardt family, pulled on the cops.
Well, yeah, but we even see this again in this episode. Yeah, that's crazy, and I think that's part of, you know, Lou even said, is he the only one clear on law enforcement? You know, that it doesn't happen like this, but it does up there. So I think he's just kind of getting a taste of what's going on and who's really in charge.
Yeah, Lou is spectacularly brave in this episode, and this is the first time. He does it again. He's later on, he's brave again. But
right.
He just offers up that this probably isn't the first time that Rye had a murder weapon involved with him. He's standing right up to their guns, right up to all their force.
Mm-hmm.
And Dodd says, well, we own judges. We don't need to kill them. He's unafraid of admitting to cops that they own judges.
Right.
And he starts to pick on Ben, and Lou steps up again and says, don't pick on him. I found the gun. Talk to me. Dance with me.
Right.
You know, forgive me if I should be terrified. I don't know you guys that well. And here's where Floyd tells Ben, you need to teach your friend some manners. And then Lou just doesn't let up. He says, well, Mike Milligan's looking for your brother, too. So it's not just police. It's like Kansas City people. Rye's gotten the attention of everybody.
But that was actually some pretty maybe useful information for Dodd to have, right? Because he didn't know Mike Milligan was looking for him, was looking for Rye.
Yeah, I'm thinking back. Are you sure he doesn't know? They just showed up. I mean, well, Joe Bulo showed up.
Yeah, I don't think they knew. I don't think they knew anything about Mike Milligan and the Kitchen Brothers going after Rob. They talked about that outside of the compound.
Okay. Can't
remember
all.
They're all trying to get to him to sway him to their opinion.
So Charlie tells Dodd that Hansi needs him, and Floyd just dismisses the cops, like, time for you to leave now. So it's total family unity. They're not divided like they appeared to be during the meeting where Dodd wanted different from what Bear wanted, and he swayed Hansi over to his side, and
Right. They
kind of separated themselves from Floyd. But they look pretty unified here in this meeting with the cops.
Absolutely.
All right, so now we go to downtown Fargo, right, Michelle? That's what that was. It looked very metropolitan.
Yeah, I think so.
Compared to Lucerne or Luverne. What is it, Lucerne or Luverne?
I think it's the first one.
Okay, we'll call it Lucerne then. So, but it looks like a big city. It's very metropolitan. Ben and Lou discuss getting a warrant, and Lou goes right into Carriage Typewriters. Established in 1945.
Right.
And interestingly, the lock on the Carriage Typewriter door is Anton Chigurh onto the floor.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah. I wonder if that was like a nod to that or something.
Of course it was. Okay. There's all kinds of nods in this thing.
Yeah, there is.
And Mike and the Kitchens are there with their sawed-off shotguns. And Lou pulls out his revolver. It's a total standoff.
Yep.
And somehow the clever statement at the prog rock band, Mike Milligan and the Kitchen Brothers, gets presented by Mike Milligan. What were you going to say? Michelle?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, what were you going to say?
This is the place where Mike Milligan kind of shows his teeth, right? This is where he, in place of being that sing-songy little voice, he gets kind of, I don't know, his inflection changes with Lou. And he was a little scary. It's real scary to me to have somebody who's always so nice and so sweet and so kind and talks like this, and then suddenly their voice changes.
He's not kind. He's just clever and funny. But
Seemingly
he
kind,
doesn't
right.
ever appear to be angry, but here he's angry.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. You have the right take. Go for it. Don't be like, right, am I right? You're right.
Okay.
just go for it. You're right. So, I don't know. I can't even remember what he says, but Lou retorts, yeah, I saw Skip at your mother's house going in the back door, like really slamming him, which was kind of funny.
That was funny.
Lou's got a sense of humor behind that lawman's face.
Yeah, I think it's just another way of him showing that he's not fearful. He wasn't scared, even though he's got this gun on him. He's still going to say what he wants to say.
He's not fearful, but he's pretty freaking funny, too. That was pretty funny.
Right, but even will like insult these people with a gun on him. So
yeah, you're right. I mean, Mike has amped it up to another gear here because he says, I like him. And oh, by the way, I met another guy like you yesterday, meaning Hank. Like, don't fuck with me, dude. I've met another important person to you, Hank. And I could probably meet him again if I need to. There's a very implied threat here.
Yeah, I thought so.
And then he totally leaves it all with like really humorous stuff. Like, they separate with peace with honor. We're both honorable by backing down from this.
And then he does some kind of Nixon quote or something.
Yeah, I'm not a crook.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all very tense, but it's all very funny too.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect blend of the comic part of it, at one point enhancing the tenseness and then letting the relief valve on it a little bit. Also, the Kitchens, when one of the Kitchens dropped their sawed-off shotgun, it just had a cord to it, and it just totally disappeared under his overcoat. Totally cool. Totally.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
He didn't have to hold the shotgun. He just let go of it, and there was like a cord that hung around his shoulder or something,
right,
and the gun hung down below his overcoat and just disappeared. And he walked out into the street like he had nothing. He had no gun. Pretty cool. Pretty well planned.
Yeah.
All right, Michelle, now I'm going to leave this next scene for you to explain. They go to Alex Auto Service, and the strange guy walks up to Lou and just says something about round oval patterns in the night, and he starts talking about spaceships, and what was the meaning of that?
No idea. I don't know why Lou pulled over there. I didn't know why they were talking about that. I didn't know why that guy came up to Lou and was talking about aliens and what they're known to do, but what he thinks they actually do. That was the oddest scene in the middle of this.
I couldn't tell either why Lou pulled in there. Maybe just to get gasoline. Because it was a gas station, service station. But
maybe that was it. Yeah, and there were so many cars because they've said so many times that you have to wait in line for gas.
1979, that was the oil crisis.
Right.
So, but Lou doesn't even wait. He just leaves after this nut talks to him. And we go to the bus now, Michelle. Peg and Eddie are on this. Peggy and Ed are on this bus, and this fantasy music, the music we heard when... what's her name was getting the chemo. Betsy was getting the chemo.
Right.
Really sweet, mystical fantasy music. Now, this explain this scene, Michelle. Ed and Peggy talk, but they don't use words, just thoughts.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if they were just showing them going home because they obviously had to take a bus home. And then it was like their conversation that they would have in bed later. And you're just kind of supposed to assume that. Or if it was supposed to be some kind of like, because they've talked about aliens and stuff so much that if it's some kind of like supposed to be almost like a telekinetic, because even at the right moment, she reaches over and touches him, like pats his arm.
So what's your take on it? What was it?
I'm going to go with the rational and say that they're showing them going home and that was the conversation that they had at night. But it was weird. It was a weird scene.
I'm going with that's the communication they had then and there.
Okay.
And it was very intelligent. I thought it was a very cool way to show their thoughts being verbalized for us to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, at Lou and Betsy's house now, there's a cribbage game going on, but it appears to be just Hank by himself. Lou comes home, Hank and Betsy are already there, but Hank's sitting there by the cribbage board. Betsy's making dinner or something. Doesn't look like she's playing with Hank.
No, she was there when he first walked in, but then she got up to get Lou some divinity, I think, some candy that she had made. They called it cake later, but they called it divinity.
Is that?
You don't know what divinity is?
No.
It's like this, oh my gosh, how to describe it? It's a confection made with egg whites and corn syrup. And it's very finicky and you have to like add the corn syrup. You have to like get it to a certain temperature and add it to the beaten egg whites, to the meringue in a really small little thin line while you're whipping it at the same time. And as it comes together, you have to know exactly when to stop it. And it was a big deal back then. My mom used to make it. She taught me how to make it when I was young and stuff. So in the 70s, it was kind of like a thing. I think it was around me. So
sounds horrendous.
No, it's incredibly delicious. You wouldn't believe it, but I mean, it's corn syrup. So.
Well, Hank says he should go and stays. Hank's odd conversations. You want to talk? No. And then they talk. And then he says he needs to go and he stays.
Right.
And they play cribbage a little bit longer. And I don't know. I really like the way that they're afraid to admit that they want to talk to each other, Michelle. They haven't mastered the social courage to just say, you know what, I'd really like to sit and talk to you. It's like the apology of their culture. Not wanting to talk and then talking and I need to go. I really need to go. Like you should go and not impose, but then you really want to stay, so you stay.
Right.
And Lou probably and Betsy wanting him to stay, but they're too afraid to say, no, stay, Dad. We really like you and we want you to be here. They just don't say anything, but he stays. It works itself out, but it's like under this veneer of social correctness for these people who don't know how to communicate real well. But then they end up communicating.
Don't you think it's just, I just think it's the sign of the times, you know? I don't know, there wasn't a lot of, both of these guys are ex-military, and there wasn't a lot of touchy-feeliness, I don't think, particularly between men in the 70s, right? I mean, certainly not like there is today. It wasn't okay, certainly back then, to express your feelings. Hey, I need someone to talk to as a grown man and stuff like that, as these people, and particularly in their situation. I don't know.
Could be a sign of the times, or it could be a sign of the geography. It's the
right.
Midwestern. We guard our feelings.
Right. Right.
Hank offers some humor of his own. He calls the Kitchen Brothers the Bathroom Brothers. gets the wrong room of the house. All right, Michelle from Tennessee, now the scene with the hole in the ground.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and that faded out, and I thought we were going to be done. You know, this has been a week for really disturbing TV, and this carried on
what
the tradition.
What faded out that you thought was going to be done?
The scene with the family, the Sulverson family, faded away, and then it faded back into Skip.
Well, the show couldn't have ended at that point. There was more to the show.
Yeah, I was hoping. It was almost over.
All right, well, it first starts out with the Dodd slapping his daughter, Simone. You embarrass me. And she tempts him. She's got some backbone to her. She's like, you hit me again. Does it get you hard? Does it get you excited? And he tells her, I wanted a boy. They're being pretty cruel to each other.
Yeah, and then he, like, closes her in the door. Did you see that? He, like, slammed the door shut and she screamed and it wouldn't go together. Like the door hit her. It was bad.
Well, then Dodd chokes Skip and asks him about Rye. Skip Strang, the typewriter man.
Yep.
Okay, Michelle, now they tell Skip to get in the hole. Now, who does this? All right, mister who's about to be killed, get in the hole where we're going to bury you. Now lie down in the hole. Who does this? Who doesn't try to fight or run or do something other than just obey people?
I don't understand. You know, that's funny because we have that same conversation here. I don't understand how someone could choke you and you could just stand there when you're literally, I understood with a typewriter when the guy had his tie. And they're pulling his tie all the time in this, which was kind of odd. Just Skip. He's getting like led around by his tie. But I can understand if it's an uncomfortable, you know, like they're tugging your tie and it's uncomfortable. But if someone's actually choking you out, I don't see how you could prevent fighting them. I can't imagine staying there with your hands down to your side. So, I don't know.
Well, but to get in a hole, it's almost like the dig your own hole out in the desert and we're going to kill you. Like, fuck you. I'm not going to dig any hole. You know, if you shoot me right now if you want to fucking kill me, then you dig the hole. I never got that. Never. Or take the shovel and start swinging and just hope you get one of them. You know, don't just do it. Don't just help them.
No, I mean, I agree. Lay down in this hole while they're backing up a dump truck? No, thank you.
Well, before he gets asphalted, he admits that Mike Milligan was looking for Rye. And then they just pull the asphalt truck up and bury him.
This is the second time that he's heard that, right? Because he just heard that from Lou.
Yeah.
So
what's worse, Michelle, getting dunked in the ice hole or getting buried with the asphalt?
Dang, I don't know. I might have to go with the asphalt. What do you think?
That's worse?
Maybe.
At least the guy who got dunked in the lake was a little bit woozy. He was like starting to wake up from getting hit with a shovel or something.
God, he had some head trauma.
Yeah. All right, then after that, Dodd sends Hansi to get Rye again. Go get him. And that was it.
Yep.
Crime should be left in the hands of criminals and not amateurs, Michelle.
Well, that's quite the motto.
Who do you think's going to take over? I think something's going to happen to Dodd. He's too much of a wild card to survive this. So if something happens to Dodd, who takes over? Bear or Charlie? Do you think Charlie's a wild card where he could rise up and become powerful?
Well, he's already shown us his intelligence and his loyalty, kind of, to the family, so sure. But I don't really think anything's going to happen to Dodd. That would be, I think something happening to Ra and Otto is probably enough trauma for the family, even though we didn't know
him. No chance. There's more death and pain to come.
Definitely, but I think that'll be at the end. I don't know that we'll see a lot of that. Maybe in the last episode or something.
I think it would be really interesting if sweet, innocent Charlie somehow got thrust into some power position where he had to make...
But come on, I mean, you'd have to go through Floyd, Dodd, and Bear for that to happen. And it could happen, but I don't think it's going to happen, like, in the next episode or two.
Do you think it's kind of interesting that in America, like the greatest country on earth, they say this sometimes with maybe Reagan said it somewhere or I heard it somewhere, but it's a double-edged sword, right? It's like greatest country on earth is great for ambition. It works for capitalists, like people that run businesses successfully. They have a huge chance of success, but also for criminals. Like you can't be a very good criminal in a repressive type government where they just kill people for stealing. They chop off your hands. You have to have freedom to be a great, either a successful business person on the legal side and on the criminal side, I think.
That's funny. I've never heard that before.
But you think it's kind of true that the freedom of our country also means freedom for criminal activity? Like that you're innocent till proven guilty?
I guess in theory that would be true.
Like, what do you think would happen in Russia if the cops came up to your house and you said, give me your guns, cops, you're not coming any farther? They'd fucking blast you. They wouldn't honor that.
Well, I don't think here very many places would be okay with that. Certainly not now. I was a child in the 70s. I wouldn't remember how it was handled back then. But two times, Lou had guns pulled on him. And I just can't imagine as a police officer that being okay, even then.
Well, he walks away from both the Kansas City guys and from the Gerhardts.
I know. I didn't understand that. Did you?
Well, it's pretty smart in both cases. He was overmatched. I mean, Lou's gonna be the outsmarter, not the overpowering type.
No, absolutely. I completely understood why he left the situation in the moment. I don't understand why that wasn't followed up on, I guess.
Well, it eventually will be.
Well, yeah.
So what do you think about the whole Sisyphus thing, Michelle? This is the end of the episode, but if you pull back farther and farther, pull your lens back, get to like 30,000 foot view, okay. We're all kind of Sisyphus, right? We're all kind of doing stuff that, in the long and short of it, doesn't really matter. I mean, 500 years from now, who's going to know what businesses I ever did or whatever, you know? I guess if you have kids, that might change your thought on that. But we're all kind of toiling for things that in the long run are pretty small.
Well, certainly most of our day-to-day activity won't have any great long-standing meaning, probably, right?
Do you think that's the ultimate meaning of Sisyphus, that it's all meaningless? Or do you think they're trying to say that it's meaningless only if you don't have a god or some sort of greater eternal truth, like they call it, to strive for?
What I read was the essay concludes that the struggle itself is supposed to be enough to fill one's heart, to fill a man's heart. So one must imagine Sisyphus happy.
Right. So we're all Sisyphus, right? We're all doing stuff that won't matter much in the whole scheme of things, but that's the recipe for our happiness. It's just happiness in our day-to-day work and failure, right. Success. It's all part of it.
Right. That just going through your day and doing your accomplishments. The way I took that was getting the rock up the hill was the accomplishment, and take joy and celebration in that. And even if the rock goes back down the hill, it doesn't negate the fact that you got it up that hill yesterday. And enjoy that. That's your struggle, and you overcame it.
All right, Michelle. Well, there's no better, more perfect way to end this episode than with that brilliant take on it.
Oh, you stop.
I'm serious. So how do people reach you for more advice from Michelle?
Oh, no advice from Michelle, but Michelle's taking advice on Twitter at Michelle from TN.
And I'm at Scathing Tweets, and this is West Coast Project and our feed for Fargo. So, Michelle, I'll see you next week for 204.
Yep.
Why do I have 104? Fear and Trembling, the Kierkegaard parable.
We'll have to read another book.
Kierkegaard was a student or a protege of Kafka. So they were both philosophers back in the way back. I don't know the years, but Kierkegaard followed Kafka's teachings and thought process.
Well, then it should be super easy to figure out.
Fear and Trembling, episode 204.
Okay.
All right, see you then.
See you then.